and welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, ecology, stories from the land, relationships, and life itself. We're your hosts, Helge Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And yes, another week. Mark, you've been traveling quite a bit.
I've been traveling. I was just in Minneapolis, there in the Midwest, teaching the Rising Stars Leadership Seminar, and which is always great. I love doing that work. And
nobody knows what that means, but you can just go on.
And
what do you do with that?
It's a seminar that I've been doing with Alan Seidner and Carolee Coulter for the last 11 years, and we work with natural food store managers and teach them how to do their job better, how to be financially successful, how to hire, fire, you know, avoid burnout, how to bring more integrity to their job.
Great.
So I've
a leadership seminar for retail stores.
For natural food retailers, yeah.
Cool.
Someone brought me cheese curds from Wisconsin.
As a gift,
yes. I remember when we've had Tamara Cost on, who's from Wisconsin, she's mentioned cheese curds. It's a big thing there. And it just really makes me appreciate all the different cultures that we have right here in the United States. From everybody who settled here from different parts of the world, they all brought their cultures with them. And it's really great when you get to try new foods.
Yes, which brings me to an amazing cultural experience I had a couple of weeks ago. I was invited to be the kind of juror, the person deciding or actually conducting the vote for Floridian foods.
Yeah.
It was a fundraiser for a movie, swampcabbagemovie.com, for more information, Swamp Cabbage, which I didn't know what it was, but you as a produce expert, of course, eat every day.
Well, I don't eat it every day, but I've had it many times in my life. And for those of you who don't know what swamp cabbage is, or you haven't seen it at your retail store, you may have seen it in a can called Hearts of Palm.
Oh, that's swamp cabbage?
That's swamp cabbage, yeah.
Palm Hearts. Anyway, that event featured kind of the unusual subculture, food culture from Florida. Things you would never even maybe find here, not just not eat, but not find. From lots of pickled things, including pickled fiddlehead fern, which I love, and I actually had fiddlehead fern kind of grilled before. Just, you know, stuff from nature that was featured there that was turned into food. And we had a great show on pickling.
Yeah, last summer, yeah. Last fall.
Yeah, last fall, exactly.
Yeah, last fall.
Yes, I think in December. Mm-hmm. And here we come, a whole variety of jerky made from meat or from animals that you don't eat
normally
in your
life.
Well,
at least here.
Yeah, if you're not exposed to it. We had alligator.
Okay, I've heard of that before.
Alligator jerky, which was very juicy. Even though it was jerky, and that's always dried, but it was one of the most juicier varieties there. We had venison, also called aka deer. We had caribou, and there's a great story of when I ate it, when I sampled it and tried it myself. The woman in front of me was like 6'6", and she said, "That's damn good." And I said, "Yeah, I never had caribou in that form. It's really yummy." And she said, "Well, I shot it."
Yeah.
So she was actually the hunter. Hunteress.
Hunter.
Yeah. We had possum because skunk was out. We had buffalo, and we had raccoon stew.
Well, and you can't get a good raccoon stew here in the Bay Area normally.
I've never seen that on any menu. It might sound appalling to some of our listeners. It was definitely very, very unusual for me. What I took home from that experience was the richness of culture. It was, you know, it's not about if we like it or not. It's not about if we reject it or if we are afraid of it or whatever our relationship to it. It is our relationship to it that's so rich and that's so interesting for me to explore. Like, I'm not, you know, for me it was not, may I find a new jerky that I really like well, but being just exposed to that and feeling the richness, the density, the variety, the sweatiness of life in all of this. I mean, it was about Florida.
Well, you were present to the invitation that was presented.
And it was incredible. It was incredible for 2 hours to just dive totally into it, be open to what comes up. I can assure you, if I see raccoon stew somewhere on the menu, I will most likely not choose it. Not that it was bad in that sense, but it has a very, very distinct taste. And you could have told me this is, you know, something that we eat every day, but it's not a taste that I was known that I ever had before. So I most likely will not choose it. But that's not the point. The point is really the thought afterwards. Is it better to eat, you know, four known animals that we eat, chickens, you know, cow, beef, pork, and what else might be on our very common restaurant list? Or does it have a place? And I'm not talking about vegetarianism or is it right to eat animals, but just like the culture of that, that they're, you know, what people eat around the world, what people eat in this country, so interesting, so interesting to follow the recipe, to follow that heritage, to follow what made, it's not about surviving. This has been part of, maybe that's how it started. I mean, even that question, right?
Well, I'm sure all of it started with basic survival.
Yes. So after all, the buffalo one.
Oh.
Because I think we're most used to that flavor and taste. But very interesting. And every single person who tried, and there were about 200 people at that event, at that fundraiser, was surprised. There was a blind tasting. Were told what it was afterwards.
Okay.
Was surprised by, you know, things like alligator. Mm-hmm. Absolutely fine, you know, chicken-like taste. Not part of our diet here in California. But anyway, very interesting experience, just like with yours, culture. I think the more we can expose ourselves, the more we become defined and refined as a being within that culture.
And appreciative, us. Right? And appreciative, yeah.
Or not, right?
Or not.
Or in the relationship of rejecting it or not liking it. Again, back to the raccoons too. But you're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today we are celebrating one of the very, very important birthdays that happened a few weeks ago, Rachel Carson. We're diving into the life and work and world of Rachel Carson, a life-changing author, most famously known for her book, Silent Spring. More on that when we come back. Listening to An Organic Conversation. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
And if I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean. And if I had a pony, I'd ride him on my boat. And we could all together go out on the ocean and set me up on my pony, on my boat. Now if I were Roy Rogers, I'd sure not be single. I couldn't bring myself to marry an old dame. Just be me and Trevor. We'll go riding through them movies, and we buy a boat and on the sea we sail.
And if I had a boat, I would go out on the ocean too. Lyle Lovett. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today we are celebrating the life-changing author for so many people, for an entire generation of environmentalists, Rachel Carson. And joining us now from Springdale, Pennsylvania, is the executive director of the Rachel Carson Homestead Association, Joy Bronstein. Joy, are you with us?
I am.
Wonderful.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being part of the show today. We are celebrating the life-changing life and authorship of Rachel Carson a couple weeks back, and also coming up soon in a few months next year, the 50-year anniversary of Silent Spring.
Yes.
Her you know, so highly influential book.
So Joy, you are the director of the Rachel Carson Homestead Association. What exactly is the Rachel Carson Homestead Association?
The Rachel Carson Homestead Association is a 501c3 organization that owns the home that Rachel Carson was born and raised in. And so part of our mission is to preserve, protect, and interpret that home. Part of our mission has to do with environmental programming in line with Rachel Carson's environmental ethic.
Oh, and just for our listeners who haven't read any of Rachel Carson's books, what would you just break that down to easily for our listeners? What would be that environmental ethic?
Sure. So she certainly focused on making sure that people live in harmony with nature. She was very concerned with the impact of chemical pesticides, the unintended consequences of our actions, and really making sure that we remember that children are born with a sense of wonder and that we can help keep that sense of wonder alive throughout their life.
She actually has a book called A Sense of Wonder. It's one of my favorite books of hers.
Absolutely. It's a fantastic book.
You know, there's a quote by her that I've always loved, and it's, "Those who dwell as scientists or laymen among the beauties and mysteries of the earth are never alone or weary of life." And it just has always stuck with me. And so what occurs at this homestead? You know, what happens? Is there an educational program?
Sure. So we're actually at a point of transition, which makes that question a really interesting one. Historically, and the organization has been around since the mid-70s, after Angelina Sober, who was Rachel's English teacher and who bought the house from their family, after she was no longer able to take care of the house. The association was formed to step in and make sure that this house would stay around forever. And it's a National Historic Landmark and a Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation asset as well. So historically, there has been programming. There's been environmental education. There's been summer bug camps with children. There have been series of lectures that go on at the homestead and tours of the home with lessons taught about Rachel Carson's legacy, trying to inspire people to connect to that legacy and make changes in their own lives, in their own environments, that would be a bit akin to what would Rachel do. Moving forward, the institution is actually changing a little bit so that the homestead will be restored back to its historic period of significance, which is when Rachel's family lived here, and it'll be turned into a world-class museum where we operate an institution that really looks at celebrating Rachel Carson's life and legacy and inspiring all people to live in harmony with nature.
Which is a great a point you're making. The Carson family lived in that house or in that area until around the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 70, 80 years ago. How much of the original flavor of how Rachel Carson grew up can still be found today? I understand your ambition is to bring it back to pretty much exactly what it was back then. But if you came today, 65 acres of land surrounding it, were you able to get a sense of how it must have been for Rachel Carson to grow up there?
That everyone that comes onto the property and comes up the drive, which goes into a wooded area with perennial and native plants planted to attract birds and butterflies and bees, and comes into the house and is able to explore it, gets a little bit of a sense of that. But it has changed dramatically since then. It's less than 3/4 of an acre now. It's in the suburbs surrounded by other brick homes. But what's really interesting and that everyone finds very poignant is that the same windows exist that are in Rachel Carson's bedroom that she would have looked out at that landscape that's so different than it was then. So it is possible to get that sense. When we're talking about restoration, though, we're really talking about the house itself and the shell of the house going back to looking like it would have looked. There have been additions put on it. There are outbuildings that are not relevant to that time period. And so I think that in the future, you'll be able to get a little bit more of a sense of that. But then when you walk inside the home, you'll be presented with a museum. Right now it's decorated with antiques that are actually being sold today.
We're talking with Joy Bronstein, the executive director of the Rachel Carson Homestead Association, implementing Rachel Carson's look on life, a life in harmony with nature, and teaching about the importance of preserving and learning from natural places and minimizing the effect of man-made chemicals in the natural system. What's the age group you are addressing at the Rachel Carson Homestead in your programs?
We have been remarkably successful in attracting in all ages of people and in attracting people in from outside of the United States as well as from the very local community. It would be hard for us to say that we have a target age audience.
Right. How many people are you attracting here? I mean, is Rachel Carson even internationally still so celebrated that people make a point and come to that destination to be engaged in her mindset? And
absolutely, absolutely. She's probably more well recognized outside of the Pittsburgh community than she is in the world.
Isn't that always the case?
It is. It is. It's fairly ironic because she is one of the iconic figures from this region. Now, in Springdale, the small town that we're in, everybody knows exactly who Rachel Carson is. But if you ask the average person on the street in Pittsburgh, they probably aren't aware of it.
And yet, you know, even though she moved away from Springdale in 1930, her work, I think it's fair to say, has changed the environmental movement forever.
Without question.
Yeah.
Without question. There are those that would credit her with sparking the modern environmental movement, and there are those that would credit her with the creation of the international environmental movement.
So can you talk about that a little bit more? What, with the release, and we have the biographer of Rachel Carson with us after this call, but just from your perspective as the executive director of the Rachel Carson Homestead Association, nationally and internationally, your view from, you know, the 1960s to now, how has her work and her book affected modern environmentalism or a new view of the relationship to between humans and nature?
Sure, absolutely. And first, I just have to say that there is no depth of expertise that I have that can touch Linda Lear, her biographer's expertise. She's done so much research, and Linda is a bit older than I am, and so she would have actually been alive and reading that book at the time when Rachel wrote it. I was born in 1975. Rachel had died a decade before of breast cancer, ironically. I think that, though, as a student, a lifetime student of environmental studies, and someone who intentionally sought out the best schools to teach environmental policy, environmental law, and environmental education, she was a figure and a consistent voice in the literature, in the science, and in the policy studies that I encountered as a college student and as a graduate student. That's a profound, profound impact on our education systems. I know also that she is held up as the iconic figure of the environmental movement. For instance, the Audubon Society gives out a Rachel Carson Award. I believe they just granted that to Sigourney Weaver. Her book, Silent Spring, is quoted and cited by every environmentalist that I've ever encountered, and I've encountered environmentalists that range from those that are bird watchers to those that are Greenpeace and Earth First activists. And they all, to some extent, lay claim to being the Rachel Carson legacy. So in a way, you know, Rachel Carson and her legacy seem to me to be a little bit of all things to all people who stop and pay attention.
Yeah, almost synonymous with mm-hmm. with the environmental movement as we know it today. Mark.
And you know, when I was listening to you, Joy, I was thinking, you know, I read Silent Spring first, and then I read A Sense of Wonder because it came out after that.
Right.
But in reality, what I read about in A Sense of Wonder, those lessons for children, mm-hmm. were absolutely led me to a greater understanding of the value of Silent Spring.
Absolutely. And let's not forget that Rachel Carson was a best-selling author prior to Silent Spring being published.
Yeah, she had several books.
Over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. If people want to make this a destination to come and visit you, you will be involved in a pretty major remodel, bringing it back to the more original beauty and character of what it was when Rachel Carson lived in her homestead in Springdale, Pennsylvania. When do you think this will be completed, or can people still do the programs throughout this year, throughout the summer? Will that stop, or
The house will be closed except for special events and special programming because it will be under construction. So it will be impossible to accommodate people in the homestead. Having said that, we're in the process of rebuilding our website, which is www.rachelcarsonhomestead.org. That will contain a lot of educational information about the homestead and about Rachel Carson. We're also opening up a visitor center and a museum off-site that will house an exhibit that we have on loan from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And that exhibit was put together by them as a reflection of what Rachel Carson meant to them as a biologist and as a scientist.
But people can still come and visit. Your programs will continue, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And if I may make a small pitch right now,
we're make being a big pitch. Yes.
Yeah, we're being considered right now by the National Trust for Historic Preservation to be a significant historic site in the country, and there's a voting campaign going on. The winner of that voting campaign would get a $25,000 historic preservation grant and national recognition and attention, which I think will help raise Rachel Carson's profile. And
sure.
So if everyone listening could go to the National Trust for Historic Preservation, it's preservationnation.org, and vote for the Rachel Carson Homestead Association. They can help us accomplish our goals.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thanks for all your work and for keeping that legacy thriving, because we certainly need everything that Rachel Carson stood for and wrote about. Joy Bronstein, thanks for being part of the show today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
The executive director at the Rachel Carson Homestead Association, as we are celebrating Rachel Carson's birthday and next year, the 50-year anniversary of her book, Silent Spring. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll be right back after the break.
What I will discover.
My name is Earl Herrick, and I am the owner of Earl's Organic Produce, a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. From the time one could find organic fruits and vegetables only in natural food stores to now, when schools and fine restaurants feature organic, we have been forging relationships with growers for over 20 years. If you want to offer the finest organic produce to your employees or customers, find us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites, available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Do you feel run down, stressed, overweight, or overloaded? Urban Remedy is a delicious 100% organic juice cleansing program designed to jumpstart your body's natural healing and cleansing abilities. This delicious juice feast, created by leading acupuncturist Nika Pasquale, is rich in vital nutrients, minerals, and enzymes, providing you with all the nutritional nourishment you need to thrive. Delivered directly to your doorstep. Urban Remedy, a convenient way to boost your energy and balance your body. Place your order today at urbanremedy.com. That's urbanremedy.com.
And we're back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today's show is about celebrating the, for many, life-changing author Rachel Carson. We just heard from Joy Bronstein, the executive director of the Rachel Carson Homestead Association, about all the great work and programs she is directing in Springdale, Pennsylvania, to implement Rachel Carson's work and conviction and belief alive in harmony with nature and the importance of preserving and learning from natural places. And it's a great honor and pleasure to now have Rachel Carson's biographer joining us from Bethesda, Maryland, Linda Lear. Linda, are you with us?
I am. Good afternoon.
Linda, you have literally spent a great portion of your life to dive into the life of another person, of Rachel Carson in this case. What's the inspiration? What is motivating you, or what's inspiring you to make Rachel Carson your topic to really understand her
life?
Well,
there were really two things that came across my life path. One was as a professor of environmental history at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. I taught a class, and when I got to talking about Silent Spring and DDT and Rachel Carson, my students had really no idea about who Rachel Carson was. It was a big Rachel who question. And I decided that that just could not continue, that there was some incredible generation gap going on, and I had to try to fill it with a book. And that book took several iterations, in the process of which I discovered my own roots and connections to Rachel in Pennsylvania, and the fact that there was so much more of this story to tell, and it became a very big book and a very life-consuming effort.
How did the book, before you even decided, before you even knew that you would decide to create a book on her work, to become her her biographer, how did just reading her book influence you? Do you remember when you picked it up and when you...
Well, I remember a very important event in what I call in my evolution with Rachel, and that was that when I graduated from college in 1962, just after Silent Spring had been serialized in The New Yorker in three great articles and was causing all kinds of alarm and consternation, etc., I received a copy of the Saturday Review of Literature, which is no longer extant, sadly, in my mailbox with an important picture, photograph of Rachel on the cover. And I had read the excerpts. I had no real idea about how this woman had decided to do this. I had only a vague notion that she was born close by to where I lived. But what impressed me was her picture on the front of this magazine and her direct, uncompromising, and very courageous gaze out at the viewer. And I wondered, what gives a woman with no institutional foundation, no real job, a freelance writer, with a child to support, et cetera, what gives this woman the courage to go against all the vested interests of science, of government, of technology, to proclaim that there is a mess out there in the natural world and that we have to do something about it?
Yeah, especially having grown up or being born in 1907, I mean, this would be courageous by today's standards.
Yes.
But we're talking turn of the century. It's a completely different life and world back then.
Correct. And I literally spent, you know, decades of my life trying to answer my own questions about what gave this woman this incredible courage.
Well, what did Rachel hope to achieve in writing Silent Spring?
I think she was hoping for the best hope she had was that it would raise questions about the truth, so-called, of science, that she hoped to ask the public to ask questions about government. She hoped to engender a skepticism in society that would not just allow us to be rolled over by vested interests. That's certainly one of her hopes. The other, of course, was to raise our awareness of what human actions were doing to the natural world.
So coming back to that courage question, what have you found in studying her and in being so immersed in her life? Why was she so? What came together for her to have that much conviction?
I think we have to remember that Rachel was a child of the Cold War, and more importantly, a child of the atom bomb, and the atom bomb completely changed her psyche. It was that bomb, that action, that made her realize that the control of nature was now in human hands.
And she was how old? Like 38?
About
45. Yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. 38.
Right, and it was a life changing experience because she felt that the hubris, the pride that humans had, that they could somehow control the world, was fundamentally at odds with her convictions as a scientist, as a naturalist, that nature was beyond human tampering.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we are joined right now by Linda Lear, Rachel Carson's biographer. Rachel Carson, life-changing author. Born in 1907, released just about 50 years ago next year, Silent Spring, the foundation of the modern environmental movement as we know it.
And Linda, you know, as you know, of course, and I didn't know until recently that she was a very prolific writer and actually an award-winning writer well before Silent Spring came out. And she was an avid naturalist. And can you give us like a little story about something that was something that was amazing about her love of the natural world, or what something that she got to do that maybe she found a lot of joy in?
Absolutely. And I do want to make the point that the reason Silent Spring took off and was able to be heard by the public was because by 1952, after Carson had published The Sea Around Us, which was a breakthrough book about the ocean, she was the most trusted voice for science in America, for public science. Carson always wrote for the public, never for just the academic community.
Mm-hmm,
And she had garnered all kinds of awards. She was on the bestseller list for 80 weeks. It was a blockbuster book. She became an international celebrity. That status gave her the power to be heard in Silent Spring.
And how was that for her? Was that something that she was comfortable with, or something?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. It was something she was well prepared for. About some of her more interesting feats as a naturalist, as I say, she wrote a trilogy, as I call it, on the ocean, beginning with her first book, Under the Sea Wind, and then The Sea Around Us, and then the last one, The Edge of the Sea, all of which are still in print and wonderful to read. She wanted to know what it was like to be under the water. She wanted to know what it was like to be a fish. She wanted to know, she had written about tides and earthquakes under the water and the newest oceanographic science. So she went to Florida and donned one of those horrible old steel helmets with all the oxygen apparatus attached to it and so forth, and went out in the Florida Keys and took a dive with a Fish and Wildlife, I'm sure, boat. Sadly, it was extremely heavy. She was not a good swimmer, but so this was very brave of her. But she wanted to see what it was like to look up and see the ocean from below, see the top of the water from below, what a fish's view would be. And so she did, but it was a very rough day. There was a lot of waves, and she got tangled up in a bed of kelp. And so her one and only dive was not the pristine, lovely, clear water that, you know, she wished it was. But nevertheless, she was able to say, I have been under the sea and I have looked up at the top.
How do you work with her? Did she keep a very tight memoir, or what's her, or like a daily, you know, calendar?
Right.
How do you go through her life?
Well, her papers are her papers were left to the Beinecke Library.
Right.
And now that I have established the Lear Center at Connecticut College, all my papers and the papers that I was given while I was doing this work for 20 years are there. Carson,
did you keep a journal?
She didn't keep a journal. She had some field notes and field notebooks. Mostly it's correspondence and it's drafts of her various books, her articles, her speeches, and the accounts that I got from her friends. I interviewed about 450 people for this book, and happily, they were still alive then, people who had known her, known her personally, and so that's really, that was really the primary source for the book, were narratives from her friends.
Beautiful. With us today, Linda Lea, Rachel Carson's biographer. Linda Lea is a biographer and historian and holds a PhD in history from George Washington University, really diving into the life of Rachel Carson for many, many, many years. You have been working on this for, what, 15-plus years at this point?
Yes, I think that's probably right. I started in about 1994, and while I've done other things, including a biography of Beatrix Potter, I always come back to Rachel.
Yes, so the question I had, there are these stories around the publishing date of Silent Spring, publishing time, the politics involved,
the efforts to silence her.
Exactly. Having been a well-published and best-selling author, which stories are true? How hard was it for her to push the envelope further with Silent Spring? That you found in your research?
It was very hard, and that for a time that it was touch and go. The chemical companies tried to sue Houghton Mifflin to stop the publication of her book, which came out in September of 62. They also tried to stop the publication of three articles in The New Yorker by suing The New Yorker. Both those publishers stood up against them and said they had done diligence on her script and manuscript and that they were going ahead with it. They then began a personal attack on Carson herself, but the book came out, and it came out, of course, after President Kennedy had made a nod to it in a press conference, which he had mentioned her Burke and the fact that he was going to put the President's Science Advisory Committee onto the subject of pesticides and their misuse.
In a way, endorsing her and her work, right?
Exactly.
Which, I mean, all these moments could have, been successful enough to stop it. Yes,
yeah.
I mean, this was all really decisive moments in the work of publishing it.
Absolutely. And it could have gone very badly at any point. And the fact that they could have sued Rachel herself, she had nothing behind her. As I said, she was not employed. She was a freelance writer. She had a family to support. She had no institutional backing. So,
but that was never risked, right? She never got sued herself.
She never got sued herself, no.
And so that conviction that she had to bring to the public what a discussion that she really loved, which was about the natural world and her care for the natural world and the natural wildlife, is really something that we can all take inspiration from.
Absolutely. It's a study in courage. And the fact that, of course, all the time that she, for the most part of the 7 years that she spent writing Silent Spring, she was dying. And she had, she used to call it a conundrum of illnesses that just beset her, one after the other. I don't think Silent Spring would ever have come to an end if it hadn't been for her secretary and assistant, Jean Davis, who was a wonderful naturalist and scientist in herself, who would type up the manuscript after Rachel could do no more and would go to bed and have it ready the next morning for Rachel to start all over again and edit. But she was a very, very ill woman, and she had to keep that secret because if the chemical companies had found out that she had cancer, they would have said that she's writing this in order to justify her own illness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Silent Spring had an effect on all of us. But as I was mentioning to Joy, our last caller, is I really loved A Sense of Wonder.
Right.
And it actually helped Silent Spring to become even more important to me after I read it. Can you tell us a little bit about how that book came about?
certainly, and I agree with you completely, because Silent Spring is a hard go. I mean, my students still have a hard time reading it. It's not an easy book, and it's a polemic book. It's a, you know, an argument for the right of the natural world to live without human humans taking it over. Sense of Wonder started out as an article for a Women's Home Companion magazine in 1958, which was titled Helping Your Child to Wonder. And she changed it, was working on it at the end of her life, hoped to make it into a bigger book, a different book, but it was not to be, and it was published posthumously with different photographs and so forth. There's a lovely new edition out with great pictures, and I'm so glad that it's there for us to read. It was the touchstone of Rachel's life, that she believed that children needed guidance in nature, and if we would take the time to go with them and to be with them in nature, they would develop a sense of wonder that she hoped we would keep forever and ever, and that would save the living world.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we're joined by Linda Lear, Rachel Carson's biographer. Linda, if you had to sum it up, besides or in addition to the information itself, what's the greatest wisdom that you found for your personal life in your work of 15 years plus to explore Rachel Carson's life?
Well, aside from her message of the living world and how everything is connected to everything else, and that we must, you know, be aware of those connections, that ecology of life, or at our peril. I think what Rachel has given to my life is a sense of courage to go on in face of adversities, varieties of adversities, and also of her intelligence in looking at the world as a place to be investigated and full of wonder always, whether it be under the sea, in a tide pool, in the woods, in the desert, on the California coast, everything that was in nature, she felt was wonderful and wonder-filled.
Did you find any regret that Rachel had in her work or in her life?
Oh, she regretted that she was going to die. She regretted that she didn't have time to write all the things that she wanted to write. She had lots of things she wanted to do. There was great sadness in that. She couldn't be in the public and really defend her book the way she wanted to be because she was so ill. But I think she believed that her words would live on and that what she wrote would make a difference. I don't think she had any clue about
how much
difference or the alarm that she would raise.
Yes, they certainly have changed the environmental movement forever. Thank you so much for your work, for keeping this amazing topic, this body of work alive, and for keep communicating the beauty and conviction of the person behind it, Rachel Carson, life-changing for many of us, for an entire generation of environmentalists.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you. It's been a pleasure. And
yes, keep up the important work. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you. Linda Lear, Rachel Carson's biographer, joined us today from Bethesda, Maryland. Linda Lear, biographer, historian, and with a PhD in history from George Washington University. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll be right back after a quick break. Stay tuned.
Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc.
Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Produce is ever-changing, seasons coming and going. At Earls Organic, we have been sourcing solely organic produce for over 20 years. Since 1988, Earls Organic Produce has been establishing strong relationships with growers and developing a deep understanding of the seasons, so you can offer the most delicious organic produce to your customers, staff, and clients year-round. For organic produce, visit Earls Organic Produce at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. Please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today's show is about celebrating the, for many, life-changing author Rachel Carson and the anniversary of her book, Silent Spring, which came out in September of 1962. Rachel Carson, environmentalist, scientist, author, best-selling author on the topic of living in harmony with nature and the modern environmental movement. We heard from Joy Bronstein, the executive director at the Rachel Carson Homestead Association, that joined us from Springdale, Pennsylvania, about the programs there to educate really all generations, but especially the youth, on Rachel Carson's philosophy, a life in harmony with nature, to preserve and learn from natural places and to minimize the effect of man-made chemicals on the natural system of the world. And all the implications of human actions on the global web of life. Followed by Linda Lear, who joined us from Bethesda, Maryland, the biographer of Rachel Carson. Linda, who has spent the last 15-plus years of her life to dive into and learn from and be inspired by the life and work of Rachel Carson that changed our view of the world and the environment. For an entire generation, actually, of us forever. We're now joined by Delta Willis, the senior communications manager at Audubon, at the Audubon Society, calling in from New York. Delta, are you with us?
Yes, indeed I am. Thank you for inviting me to come on.
Thank you for making the time to be part of the show today here on An Organic Conversation. We are celebrating the life and work of Rachel Carson today, and we thought it would be a perfect segue to bring up your Rachel Carson Award. Tell us first, though, what does the Audubon Society do and stand for?
The Audubon Society was established over a century ago by some ladies in Boston, including the leader Harriet Hemingway. This was in 1896, and they protested birds being slaughtered for their plumes for these fashionable hats. And that led to the Audubon Society being founded.
First about, and still very focused on birds, bird sanctuary, bird protection, as riparian zones are kind of often the lung of everything that's going on and a reflection of everything that's going on the land and in the oceans.
Well, what we found is that birds are early indicators of environmental damage that,
yes,
that will eventually affect people, which was the legacy of Rachel Carson. I mean, they remain our canaries in the coal mine. as far as being early indicators.
Literally, yes. And that first protest in 1896 makes the Audubon Society one of the older or oldest environmental environmentally focused environmental organizations in the United States.
Yes, this is true, and we're still going strong. Only a few years ago, in 2004, we established the Women in Conservation wing with the Rachel Carson Awards, but we've had some fascinating winners of that honor, including Bette Midler, who is the founder of the New York Restoration Project, which created gardens all over New York City.
Tell us about the motivation of that award. So in 2004, the Audubon Society designed this conservation award especially for women, right? It's only female leadership is being honored.
That's right. Visionary women whose dedication, talent, and energy have advanced the environmental movement locally and globally. Sigourney Weaver and Maya Lin were our honorees only last Monday.
What are winners? What's the criteria to pick a winner in that category to honor an outstanding contribution to the environmental work the Audubon Society stands for?
Well, it's been fairly focused on influences in North America, but as we know, everything is global. There are such fantastic links, obviously, with the birds that migrate across the Americas. And it's a diverse group of honorees. For example, Laurie David, the producer of An Inconvenient Truth, mm-hmm. and Majora Carter, the founder and executive director of Sustainable South Bronx. So there's lots of different categories of winners that have been named, but they're certainly all inspiring. And they're all very active today.
And so your current winners, can you just give us a little idea of what they are up to that garnished this award?
Well, Sigourney Weaver is increasingly active in the environmental realm, and she is the honorary chairperson of the Dian Fossey Gorilla Fund. And you know that she played Dian Fossey in Gorillas in the Mist. She's also testified before the UN General Assembly, speaking out against deep sea trawling. And just last week, she penned an op-ed that ran in the Huffington Post about why we shouldn't have another Silent Spring, that the kind of reaction that Rachel Carson got when she came out with her evidence against DDT, the way she was bashed is the same thing that's going on now with the scientists who talk about climate change, that they're trying to discredit them when the evidence is clearly there.
We're speaking with Delta Willis, the senior communications manager at the Audubon Society, one of the oldest environmentally focused organizations, nonprofit organizations in the United States, that started in 1896. As a protest for harvesting or killing birds for their plume.
And I was wondering about your Women in Conservation program. Is there an educational arm of it that is connecting girls or young women to the environmental movement?
Yes, indeed. There's a website, womeninconservation.org. There's also an internship program where young women can apply to. They actually join us at our headquarters in New York City, and they learn about the nonprofit world. They helped us produce the exceptional event last week, which had 400 people in the Plaza Ballroom and a very entertaining and complex program that was emceed by Ann Thompson, the environmental correspondent for NBC News.
But your programs really year-round are absolutely national and maybe even international in reach. People can find local chapters virtually throughout the entire country and get involved and volunteer. I know you have a big kind of clean-up day throughout the year and activities to restore bird habitat and learn about our connection to the natural world.
Yes, and there are resources online. There's an Audubon at Home program, which can be found at audubon.org, which discourages the use of pesticides in people's backyards. And we continually find that what's bad for birds is bad for people. So if you reduce pesticides in your backyard, it's safer for children, it's safer for birds. You don't have the runoff that goes into the water system when it rains. And there's all sorts of tips online about how you can have a healthier environment. And of course, everyone's backyard can extend to the local park or whatever region you want to reach out to. We do also have Audubon centers around the country, and you can find them at the same website, audubon.org, by simply entering your zip code.
Again, the website is audubon.org. Delta, as the senior communications manager at Audubon, on a personal note, how has Silent Spring, that kind of landmark book that started the modern environmental movement here in the United States, or just really a fundamentally new look at nature and our relationship to it, how had it effect? What was the effect for you directly? Do you remember when you first picked it up?
Well, she wrote, "Contemplate the beauty of the earth, and then demand that our lawmakers protect it." And I'm still contemplating the beauty of the earth. I'm going to Kenya on a safari in a couple of weeks' time, and I love it. It's the cathedral where I worship, and I think that I don't know how life would be for me if all these beautiful things weren't here to contemplate.
Mm-hmm. And in all your
so true.
Yeah, and in your work, are you finding that more and more women or people are receptive to the message of the Audubon Society?
Oh, yes, indeed. There's a whole great movement of green moms. They do the shopping and they make many of the choices. And as Sigourney said in her acceptance speech, the women were the resource and the housekeepers, and they had to keep up with the natural resources. So it's kind of natural that they would be involved in the environmental movement. By the way, her speech is on YouTube. If you look for WIC, that's WIC for Women in Conservation, Sigourney, and it's only 8 minutes long, and it's just people are passing it around. It's viral. They just love it. They're sharing it.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Inspiring work. Her work in 1962, all this, you know, everything that it unleashed, all the projects and the work that is inspired by it, including this award that you now give out since 2004, focusing on women and leadership and conservation, all in one way or another connected, as we all are connected, to Rachel Carson's life and work. Beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us today and for all you do with the Audubon Society. Please keep it up.
Okay, thank you. My pleasure.
Great. That was Delta Willis, the Senior Communications Manager at Audubon, which is the Audubon Society. The website is audubon.org. That's AUDUBON.org. And before that, we were joined by Linda Leah, Rachel Carson's biographer, who joined us from Bethesda, Maryland. And the beginning of the show, Joy Bronstein, the executive director of the Rachel Carson Homestead Association from Springdale, Pennsylvania, celebrating Rachel Carson's birthday. What a great life. How much great work. So important, Mark.
How inspiring.
Yes.
Absolutely. An Organic Conversation is a production of the Organic Media Network. Associate producer, Gina Rustani.
For our blogs, podcasts, and more information on this show and previous shows, please visit our website at anorganicconversation.com.
You can also follow us on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter, and we'd love to hear from you. So please send us your comments and questions to share@anorganicconversation.com.
Coming up next is Beth Greer and Your Supernatural Life. Great show right after this show, so please stay tuned. We're your hosts, Helge Helberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll be back right here, same place, same time next week. See you then, and thanks so much again for being part of An Organic Conversation.
Bye-bye now.
Strengthen me.